I think I'm on now. There we go. I didn't watch a lot of news, but I do know that Air Canada ended their strike, right? You saw that in the news, Air Canada. There supposedly were thousands from Canada, especially, or people going to Canada that weren't able to get flights. It threw off all these things. But one of the things, you know, I'm making, you know, there's various views on strikes and all that. I mean, no commentary on this, but there are, if you watch any strikes, what they all do is they have their chance, right? They're on the picket line. And so here's what Air Canada used in the last week, the employees. Unpaid work won't fly. That was their sign. I'm assuming it went something like, unpaid work won't fly, or I don't know. Unpaid work won't fly. Unpaid work won't, I don't know. But they chant it, right? Or another one, they said, no flights without our rights. No flights without our rights, right? Because they were fighting for better pay. They also did, shame on you. Pay my due. Shame on, so that was another one they used. And then as everybody started losing, right, they're doing it to hopefully get attention, but then when flights started getting backed up, they had to change their tune and be like, oh, we need some empathy. So they changed to, don't blame me, blame AC, which is Air Canada, right? Because they want to make sure that's where the problem is. But you know this of any strike, don't you? Those who are picketing will say their chants or say their phrases. Why? Because it helps a lot. It helps in a variety of ways, but one thing it does is it brings, all the articles on this say, because I did my research, it brings this solidarity, right? It brings this community of like, we're all in this. This is what we're about. But it also reminds them, because after a while, when the pain sets in of not getting pay or getting criticism, right, it's like, oh yeah, this is our North Star. This is why we're doing it. This is our purpose and our meaning, right? And so it adds a repetition that keeps reminding them and then engages their hearts in a sort of, could we say, imagination about why are we doing this again? Oh yeah, I can imagine a better world where we have better pay. For those of you that remember, I just pulled the thread on three topics that were in our identity conference. We did a while ago this identity conference with finding our identity in the gospel versus modern traditional identities, and we're picking up in that theme. But in our last lecture or talk on that, the speaker pointed out that the way you are formed has to do with your community, what's repeated, and what captures your attention. Right? Those on the picket line get it. They get that that shapes them. So this is important to consider, because did it feel a little bit like you were chanting when you were reading? It was supposed to, right? You were supposed to be engaged with repetition in community toward your imagination, toward this love, right? Let's close in prayer. Now, but that's what we've been talking about. That's our current series, because off of our identity conference, as the speaker did there and the elders here have said, we want to talk about now, what do you springboard toward? What are the ways that we are being formed, and what loaded practices, we're calling it, what things do we want people at Hope involved in to help shape their imagination in community through repetition? And the first one we come to is this one on worship, what we're doing today. And I want to use this psalm. Some of you may remember, this is one of my favorite psalms, so you might hear me allude to it a lot. I preached on it in 2000, so those of you that remember that sermon can check out. I don't really remember it that well, but I did it differently there. We didn't talk about worship then. But here's where we're going. I just threw away my forecast for you note takers. Sorry. Three things. What this psalm is presenting, how it relates to worship, and why it matters. What this psalm is presenting, how it relates to worship, and why it matters. Okay? So that's where we're going. What this psalm is presenting, I want you to either make lines in your worship guide, have the psalm out, or get a pen. Because I want you to put lines on it. Between verse 3 and 4, draw a line to divide it. Between verses 9 and 10, draw a line, either with your fingernail or a pen. Between verses 16 and 17, draw a line. Between verses 22 and 23, draw a line. I'm going to repeat that as we go, so if you missed them, don't worry. But I'm doing this because if you read this psalm, it has these chunks. Now, we get distracted because we get so, you know, verbose with just saying the same line. That's what I think. And we're supposed to. But we don't miss the story it's telling. And it's walking us through. So look at this first one, 1 through 3. I had you put a line between 3 and 4. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. It's talking about God's eternal character. He is good. Give thanks to the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the true God. So it starts where? His eternal character, I said. It starts in eternity. Calling us to give thanks. But then the next section, I said section 4 to 9. So you should have that section. What does it turn to? We're not reading his love endures forever. We're just reading the other parts. He does great wonders. By his understanding did what? Made the heavens. And if you notice, you can look at it later, this picks up wording from Genesis 1:9, Genesis 1:16, and Genesis 1:17. The God of creation. Right? So we've moved from eternity, and we're now into his first act of work, creation. Right? So here he is creating. Genesis 1 and 2 gets echoed in here. So he's the creator. So you could put a title over that creator, Genesis. But now I had you put a line between 10 and 9. And so what happens here in the shift in 10? To him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt. Bible trivia. When does that happen? Are we still in Genesis? We've moved on to Exodus 12. Right? And then not just that, look at what verse 11, he brings Israel out. That's 12, Exodus 12 and 13. And then with a mighty arm, he did that in verse 12 of our psalm here. But then did what? He divided in verse 13, the Red Sea. When does that happen? Exodus 14. So we've now moved from Genesis 1 to Exodus 12 to Exodus 14. And we're moving along. So verse 14 here in our psalm, he brought Israel out through the midst of it, and he swept Pharaoh away. That happens in Exodus 12. To him who led his people through the wilderness. Bible trivia, when's that happen? A lot now. Now we're going to fast forward. The end of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. This is a phrase actually picked up from Numbers. But then also Deuteronomy. So do you see what he's doing? Eternity past, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And then he continues. So we put a line between 16 and 17. To him who struck down great kings. When did he do that? Well, he gives us an example in 19 and 20, and that's Sihon and Og, or Sihon. Now that happens in Numbers 22, I believe. But it gets repeated in Deuteronomy too, as a reason to take the land with the new generation of God's people. We're not going to get into all that history. But what's my point? What's this psalm doing? It started in eternity past. It went to Genesis and creation. It now is into Exodus and the rescue from all the brokenness of the world. And it did Exodus. Then it does Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. It has this encouragement from Deuteronomy about Sihon and Og. And then what's it say here at the end of this section? I said put a line between 22 and 23. Look at verses 21 and 22. And gave their lands as an inheritance to the servants of Israel. Bible trivia, when does Israel take up inheritance? Not in Genesis, not in Exodus, not Leviticus, Numbers, not Deuteronomy. They're supposed to go. They do it where? Joshua. He is summarizing, the psalmist, these first 6 books of the Bible. The story of my great-great-great-great-great-grandparents is what he's saying, right? And what's the theme? His love endures forever. When you look back on your great-grandparents' story, it was a story of hardship and they cleared a lot of stumps to make the land. No, it was a story of love. When you look at your grandparents and they went through the Depression, oh, it was so hard. Yes, but it was a story of love. When you look at your parents and as they made themselves as boomers or whatever, it was a story of love. But then notice what he does in 23 and 24 and 25. He remembered who? Us. So he comes to your story, my story, today. Where did you wake up? To the present. in this present. And what's our story? It's a story of love. What are you to be chanting? He's saying, it's a story of love. So do you see, when I say what this psalm is doing, it is laying out the story of God's people. And it is saying, there is one thread to pull through it. There is one theme to see through it all. And that is that God is a God of love, working out his purposes. Because Jason had said that about his song he was singing, I'd given him the idea of earworm, but just think about it. Here's where I'm going. Many of us older folk here, if I say, give me a break, give me a break. Break me off a piece of that Kit Kat bar. Why? Because it was an earworm that got stuck in your head, seeing it over and over and over. And what does the psalmist want? Your earworm is to be, for his steadfast love endures forever. His love, and that's why I like the NIV, because they kept it. It's six syllables in the Hebrew, really quick, to be like this staccato. For his love endures forever. For his love endures forever. That is to be your earworm. And, you know, I picked Kit Kat, but we could do the same with Liberty, Liberty, you finish it. Liberty. Or I've been told, for the youngsters here, that there's something on TikTok about nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. I don't know that, but that's like another earworm that's there, right? And this is important, because why is the psalmist doing this? Because you have a lot of other earworms that play in your head. God is displeased with me and really angry. Maybe God is not even there and we are just on our own figuring it out. Or maybe he's there, but he's like the deistic God and he's just really distant. Or he's more like Allah and really distant and so other, and oh, maybe we can make our way there. Or is he the God of gracious love, who for eternity past lived in love because of the Trinity loving one another, and they just had to blow it out to other people, and so they created and they rescued what? Anyway, you get the point. It's this story of love, and the psalmist wants you to know it. So this is what, point one, what is this psalm presenting? When we think of our story and the story of all time, it is a story of love. It is a story of God working in love, or let me read what I have. The true story of the Bible is a story saturated with the love of God over and over. You felt it while you read it. Don't be deceived. It's a story saturated in love. But how, secondly, does that relate to worship? How does that relate to worship? We're talking about worship today because we're talking about practices. Look at verse 1. Give thanks to the Lord. And then it repeats itself, right? I have lost my page in my Bible, and I got to get back there so that I can follow along with you. 136. Root. Too many papers, right? Give thanks to the Lord. And then the first three verses all start that way, right? Look how it ends. Last verse. Give thanks to the Lord. But here's the interesting thing. Listen to what one commentator wrote on that word, yada, give thanks. Derek Kidner wrote, give thanks is not the whole meaning of this word. It calls us to a thoughtful, grateful worship. Because I hear thanks and I think Thanksgiving Day. Like, thank you for that, right? I try to say thank you a lot. My parents trained me well. But this is actually a call to thankful worship. An example of why we say that, I pulled out my New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis. And so you know, this is all Hebrew words. This is volume 2. There are 5 of these that help me get long articles on what our Hebrew words mean, right? So I pulled out one on this, and I won't bore you. I have some stuff I was going to read. But it points out this fact, is that at its root, it means to acknowledge. So, for example, if you know the story of Job, right? He loses everything. He's in a bad way. His friends try to comfort him. But at the end, God shows up. And God says, did you make these things? Are you able to push against this as much as you think? Brace yourself like a man and answer me. And God says in there, in Job 40, if you can, if you have the same strength as me, then will I also yada. Thank you? No. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. So it has to do with this calling to mind the greatness in a grateful way, because it got mixed, this Hebrew word, with the thanksgiving offering in the Old Testament, if you again do your Hebrew reading. And so that's where people are like, we think, because there's so many words for worship, that this had a thankfulness kind of looped in with it. But do you see what I'm saying? This psalmist is not just saying, hey, be grateful like Thanksgiving Day. He's saying, worship the Lord. As you think about this story of love, come in with this acknowledging, exploding heart of gratitude and worship for him. This psalm is actually also about worship. He begins and ends it that way. To say that the true story of reality is this story of love. Now, that's what we do in worship. Let me remind you first of our big honkin' story in the Bible, right? God existed through, we kind of walked through some of it. God existed for all of eternity. Out of his great love, he just had to share relationships. So he creates the world and it's all good. But what happens? Mankind says, no, thank you, God. I will do my own thing. I don't like you. And the world is crushed and broken in sin. But God says right away, I will rescue it. And he goes on to rescue. And years until he finally comes, because we couldn't do it ourselves. He rescues us in Jesus, living for us and dying for us. And Jesus rises from the dead, shattering sin and death, so that he can offer to everyone life eternal. And he will one day return to bring a new heaven and new earth where God's goodness is restored fully. That's the story of the Bible. What's the earworm in it? His love endures forever. His love endures forever. If that's the story of the Bible, what's the story of your worship guide? The exact same one. Why do I say that? Let's think about what I just laid out. Start on page one, gathering song, but then we have the call to worship. Whose call is it? The God of eternity. Yeah, my children's church teachers are going, can I stand up and teach this, right? The God of eternity past calls in to us and says, in my goodness, come. I know where life is found, right? So he creates a people and a place to come experience his goodness. And then in that goodness, what do? We have an adoration song, right? It's like Genesis 1 and 2 all over again. There is goodness. There is a God. But then you turn the page in that adoration song. We hear his word and we go, oh yeah, Genesis 3. I am a broken and sinful person. Our world is broken and needs redemption. So what do? We do a prayer of confession, saying like, Lord, I need your redemption, this redemption you've promised. But then right out of that, what do we hear? Flip the page to page 3 of your worship guide. Comfort and assurance of the gospel. We're moving through the story of the Bible to now saying like, you are redeemed by a God who rescues by grace. And then what's God do in that? From that, he creates a people. He's always been creating a people out of his grace. And so we hear his through his word. So we hear his word. We talk about the life of the people. We pray as his people for a broken world. You see how we're walking through the story of the Bible? Because that's what God did. And then there will come a time in celebrating that. We have communion, of course. You might say the high point. We'll talk about that later. But then we're sent. Because he's always been sending his people, but sending toward what trajectory? Toward a trajectory of hope, right? Of his final restoration, of making all things new. And so the Lord bless you and keep you until he gets us home as we're sent. But do you see that this very thing is not just like, hey, what's Todd want to do? Jason made this one because we share doing it. What did Jason want to do this week? No! The church has always historically done worship this way because they want you and me in this story today. Today. And that's what the psalmist knows. And so he says, give thanks. Come worship with this abounding gratitude. It works something like this. Laura and I have tried this summer to hit some of the summer blockbusters. So I'll just choose the first one we saw. It was May. It was kind of beginning of summer, but Mission Impossible, Final Reckoning, Final Installation, it's all done. Tom Cruise was great, right? If you went and saw that. But when we went to Zeus Theater, and sat in there. The lights went down, the music went up, and I did some research on this. Did you know that Mission Impossible Final Reckoning was filmed in London for many of its city scenes, in Alberobello, I don't know, Italy? Yeah, those of you who've been in Sicily and Italy. Also in Puglia, Italy. And then a lot of its outdoor, really beautiful scenery was South Africa, right? And so what happens when you go to see Final Reckoning in a theater? Like you are, the lights go down, the music goes up, you have this massive screen, and I am in Italy, I am in London running on these scenes, right? But I never left Waynesboro. So when the lights come up, it's really disorienting, isn't it? Because all of a sudden they come up and I have to go, oh yeah, I have to go back and respond to email. Right? I just had an immersive experience of a different story. It's a different story. But in worship, we are to have an immersive experience of the true story. So that when we wake up and get oriented and go, I have to respond to email, we go, oh yeah. But this is the story of how I respond. This is the story that informs how I go to work. This is the story of how I interact with my family. Because we've been immersed walking through the true story of what God has always done in his love. Does that make sense? A little bit, maybe? So before I move on to our third point, you know, this is where you have to go, why do you come to worship? I just always have, honestly. I'm the son of two pastors' kids, and pastors are one thing, but their kids carry enough guilt, right? Like, if the doors were open, we had to be there. I just always did that. And so soon it becomes duty. It's become what's expected. No, it's my commitment. You know, what's my why that's got you here? Oh, I have friends there. It's a good community. Could it be that as you show up, this would be your elder's invitation, that you come with lenses going, oh yeah, immerse me in the true story that I'd live differently this week in that true story. That's the invitation, because, final point. So, what's this psalm presenting? First point. How's it relate to worship? Final point, why it matters. Oh, sorry, checking my clock. Why it matters. Look at verse 23 and 24 again. We talked about this. He remembered us and freed us. That's where it goes to application, doesn't it? The present, or as one commentator said, the continuing love of God. Is he continuing in your life? And see what this does, if it's a story about immersing us in the great work of what God's been doing throughout his story, then those verses have a question mark. Though they're not written there, and they're not worded that way. But what I mean by that is they're going like, so what's your story? What are your alternate stories? What are your other stories? That's what we were asking in our identity conference, right? That our speaker used that idea of like, we all can go to church and go like, I know Jesus and I know this grace thing we're talking about, but down here he used this gesture. I'm really working out of this approval. And so I want a lot of likes on my social media. Or money, and so I've got to get a really good education. Yeah, I appeared, ask me the quiz, and I can answer all the gospel things, that we've got other stories that are informing who we are. And so there's a lot of places that we could go on this, but I just wanted to pause at the start to think of, because we're talking grand stories, of where we are as a culture at various grand stories. You could say that in many ways, we have a realistic option, an evolutionarily informed realistic option, right? Like, I'm on a rock hurtling through space right now. How'd this rock get here? It came out of cold nothingness. Things happened with lightning and all that. We're now hurtling through. That's pretty cool. But the sun's going to one day go out, and we're going to be on a rock dead hurtling through. It's not a very happy one. And so, for example, Leo Tolstoy wrote this. The question, he wrote this after a very successful life at 50 years old, and realizing that every loved one had been taken from him. He said, the question was, why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? And so knowing that we lend towards denying it, he then continued, how can we humans fail to see this? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. As soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud and a stupid fraud. That's one story. And then, like he mentioned, we can go like, oh no, just get intoxicated with life. So our postmoderns come along and go, no, yes, you're just running through life. There's nothing here, but just make meaning where you are, right? Just create your own meaning. Well, how does that work for you? Because for one, it's Moana. This again goes to for those who didn't watch the conference, right? Is Moana and Frozen were illustrations like you can be come out who you really are and you can be anybody you want to be. Really? Like, if I want to win America's Got Talent, you've heard me. You know it ain't gonna happen. There's limits, right? But then not only that, does that really work for you in the end? And so here I'll use another brutal reality of thinking. Thomas Nagel, NYU philosopher, wrote, even if you produce a great work of literature which continues to be read thousands of years from now, eventually the solar system will cool or the universe will wind down and collapse and all trace of your effort will vanish. The problem is that although there are justifications for most things, big and small, that we would do within life, none of these explanations explain the point of your life as a whole. It wouldn't matter if you had never existed, and after you have gone out of existence, it won't matter that you did exist. And so he's just simply saying, will you be honest? Because you say, no, I can create meaning. That matters. I'm in a story that matters because I tried to create this meaning. He goes, no, can we just be honest? You can't create a meaning on or a story on your own that matters. But these are options for us, and we wake up every day tempted to whistle those tunes. Or go to another one. I love this. So in light of that, as there's something, though, I did some reading this week. There's another story we could have. It's called the Q effect. Have you heard this? I think our doctors have probably heard this, or the Q word. But in policing and in medicine, there is a cuss word you can't say. Nurses, quiet. How's the shift? It's quiet shift. So a policeman wrote this. It's an article that I ran across. A policeman, where'd this quote go? The unwritten rule of policing is that you never, ever, ever say it's quiet. It is the curse of all curses, which just invites trouble and tempts fate. And then, literally, the Bulletin of Royal College of Surgeons did a study in hospitals. And here's what it was. I'm drawing from an author. But the study deploys a multi-centered, single-blind, random control trial where at the end of the handover meeting of a shift, the doctor would say, one doctor would say, have a quiet night. The other one would say, have a good night. And here's what their study found. When the word quiet was used, a significantly higher number of admissions occurred during the night on-call period. What's my point in that? Another story that comes is that I don't know what's out there, but I know I'm small. And I know there's something that's out of my control, and that is, call it fate, call it Allah, call it something, but there is a big force that is really in control, and I just make believe that I'm in control. And that's a story that even some Christians have. Because the truth is, in that story, what is fate like if we just call it fate? Do you like fate? Will you pursue fate? As a matter of fact, I kind of want to just keep fate over here. Don't you? Like, I hope I just don't make fate mad today, so I won't say the Q word. I never cuddle up. I never can say, for fate's steadfast love endures forever. Never. There's other stories, but I'll stop there, because why is this important? Because there's one story that matters. and all these other ones that are searching for meaning and searching to matter. And it is that there was an eternal God who didn't begin in just this way of going, let me be your fate. He loved his son. The Father loved his son, and they loved the Spirit. Jesus says this in John 14 and in John 17. And he says, my whole reason for coming was that you would know God's power. No, he says that you would know the love of the Father. So he says, for example, in John 14, I want the world to know that I love the Father. And then in John 17, 26, Jesus says he would continue to make God's known and said, quote, I will continue to make it known so that the love with which you have had, so that the love with which you have loved me may be in them and I in them. Why does this matter? Because it is the one story of love that matters. Let me close. Is it any wonder, I hope, that when I'm on vacation, worship, that I... Because I'm starting, I don't know about you, but I start to hear other stories louder than I should, because I need this regular repetition that there is one story of love I need to walk through. I need to be with God's people. Community, imagination, repetition in worship. And then I was even thinking, you know, as the worship team, as we talk together about this, and I thought, one of our greatest crimes is making worship boring. And so we want to hear if that's what you experience. But I also encourage you to come in, because we need your enthusiasm here. We need your going, give thanks, because it's contagious, isn't it? You help me not experience a boring worship service here. And I don't say that to shame. It's just stuff that as we go like, oh, Lord, what lenses do I bring to this gathering? And how do you help me step into that immersive experience? There's more, but let me pray. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Trinity of love, overflowing to a world that needs you, our hearts need you. And so fill our ears with the earworm of your love endures forever. And may you use our worship service to maybe even do it a little more and more in a dramatic way, that we'd be different people for the love of our area and friends and world. In your name we ask these things, and all God's people sang, amen. Amen.